With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi, and thanks for joining us once again. Hope you're having a great weekend. Several things to talk about today, including a big free flu vaccine opportunity coming up in the St. Louis area, the latest on new car seat regulations, and we'll find out about the dangers of those baby walkers. But first, let's start this week's show like we do every show with our co-host, SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. Dr. Patel is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital, and he's an infectious diseases specialist. Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be here.
Wanted to talk to you about a new study that finds people who share hospital rooms are much more susceptible to a particular kind of infection than those who don't.
Researchers at the University of North Texas looked at more than 1 million patients at hundreds of hospitals in the state and found that those in double occupancy rooms had 64% more central line infections than those in private rooms. Study co-author Se Juan Park says such infections
result in thousands of deaths each year.
The chance of being assigned to a private room differs by race, with blacks and Hispanics more likely to be assigned to double occupancy rooms. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
I guess there are two things here. The fact that this study says you're more likely to get a central line infection if you share a room, which is one story. And then I guess the other one is just central line infections in general. Let's talk about central line infections in general. What are they and how dangerous are they?
Central line infections are infections associated with what's called a central venous catheter, central line. Central lines are placed into large blood vessels, and they can deliver medications rapidly, and certain types of medications that are very toxic can be delivered into the largest amount of blood volume, so they're rapidly diluted and can take effect very quickly. So they're frequently used tools, especially when patients are sick and coming into the hospital in a critically ill situation. We use central lines quite frequently in the ICU, in the emergency department, in the operating room. They're very important tools for the appropriate and safe delivery of healthcare. But anytime that you have a device that is going through the skin, there's a risk of infection. And so we want to take as many steps as possible to reduce that risk of infection.
I know infections like those are closely tracked in an attempt to lessen the chance of getting them. What sort of things are done to lower the risk of central line infection?
Well, there's a lot of different steps that we take. One is using what's called the insertion bundle. So whenever a central line is placed, it's placed using this a bundle of different elements, all of which have been proven to help reduce the risk of infection associated with the central line. There's also very important maintenance components when you're managing a central line. So the dressing has to be intact. It has to be taped down and really sealed shut, so to speak, so bacteria can't get inside. Using a good technique to prevent infection or contamination of the line when you're using it for infusion medications or for blood draws or whatever, that's all very important as well. Perhaps the most important intervention, though, is to not have the central line. You can't really have a central line infection if you don't have a central line in place. And so getting people treated and healed and then getting that line out as soon as possible is perhaps the most important intervention.
What's the treatment if you get this infection?
Typically, the treatment is twofold. One, remove the infected line. It's very hard to treat an infection on a plastic device, so to speak. So once the catheter is infected, the catheter typically has to be removed. And then, of course, the use of antibiotics. So you'd want to use antibiotics for that work against the bacteria that's causing the infection and provide enough of a treatment course to clear out the infection. That frequently requires another IV access device sometimes another central line. And so that can be what can be very frustrating and start a vicious cycle that is self-perpetuating. You get one infection, you then end up being at risk for having a second infection because you have another central line in place.
Dr. Patel, I wanted to talk to you about antibiotics and the overuse of antibiotics. Do you think that's a legitimate concern?
Absolutely. The overuse of antibiotics is a tremendous concern because we don't have enough antibiotics, so to speak, and the bacteria are becoming more and more resistant to the antibiotics that we do have. So then we have to turn to bigger and more toxic drugs, and eventually, and with some infections, this has already happened, we've exceeded any available antibiotics. So the infections are becoming completely resistant to some of the treatments we have. And if we don't have any treatments available, then patients can die from previously treatable infections.
How adamant are some patients that they get an antibiotic?
Patients are fairly adamant because they are concerned that they're going to experience an adverse outcome because of, not getting the antibiotic in time. And that really is a legitimate concern, absolutely. But there's frequently the case the infection may be caused by things that are not treatable by antibiotics, for example, a virus, or that in a particular situation, antibiotics may not be the appropriate treatment. Or sometimes you don't need the biggest gun antibiotics, sometimes going to old reliable antibiotics, which may be more narrow and more targeted towards the infection itself rather than trying to cover everything, is a better choice.
We've been talking about antibiotics. Just wanted to toss this out to you. What do you think about probiotics?
Well, probiotics can help reduce the need for antibiotics and can help recolonize your body, so to speak, with normal, safer, if you want to say, bacteria. The bacteria that normally live on us or in us, those are what are recolonized with probiotics. The challenge with probiotics, though, is that your body's bacterial composition is very complex. And so one or two, four or five components are not enough to replicate, if you want to say, the diverse, naturally occurring bacteria that live on us.
Are you an advocate of using probiotics?
I would say I am a thoughtful advocate in the sense that I think about it for an individual patient. I wouldn't necessarily say that I use them all the time, but I'm not opposed to them if used in the appropriate situation.
Do some people take them like a vitamin?
People do. And in my mind, that's not necessary per se. I think it's important to eat a balanced, healthy diet. Eating things like yogurt or kefir milk or other cultured products such as that can recolonize you with the right types of bacteria naturally and don't need to take a pill to do that. So it can help for some individuals, though, that are especially on long, prolonged courses of antibiotics for weeks or months at a time. And for those people, obviously the antibiotics themselves are killing these bacteria, the natural ones, the good ones, if you want to say. And so probiotics can be helpful in those situations.
We're talking with SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. Here's a story that caught my attention. In Iowa, a number of clinics there are using robots as doctors.
Artificial intelligence is now being used to diagnose eye disease. It's happening at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. The device just received approval from the Food and Drug Administration in April and is able to diagnose a diabetes complication that can cause blindness. The device uses software and an eye camera to take pictures of a patient's retina and analyzes the images just as a doctor would. Doctors there say they see a great future in a robot-like device being able to detect and diagnose other diseases too. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Dr. Patel, what's the future of robotic care?
I think the future is quite bright and promising. And this is a very good advance, if you want to say. They've used similar technology for detecting very difficult to detect breast lesions in mammograms. And so the whole point is that you can train, if you want to say, this artificial intelligence platform to do the pattern recognition that human specialists, human physicians are trained to do. That pattern recognition is frequently seeing the same types of patterns in different situations. And once you can get good at that, once you can get the programming right, then it can reduce the risk of a miss in this fairly tedious and repetitive type work.
robotic care aside, what's your thinking on telemedicine?
Well, I think it's a quite interesting field, and it brings the world of medicine a little closer to home. Folks can now sign up for services where physicians or healthcare providers are accessible either via FaceTime or their smartphone. Or if in the setting of telemedicine in the clinic, a specialist who may be hundreds of miles away can provide their expertise to a rural or more inaccessible area. And so patients can benefit from that expertise versus having to travel hundreds of miles to see that specialist.
Dr. Patel, thanks. And come back again at the end of the show for your health tip of the week. Dr. Neera Patel is a SLU Care Infectious Diseases Specialist and the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Up next, we'll talk about the flu and a chance for all of us to get a free flu vaccine next weekend. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. On the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bonomer. Did you get your flu shot yet? I wanted to talk about an opportunity coming up next Saturday for free flu vaccinations throughout the St. Louis area. They're being offered by SSM Health. Here to talk about that and the flu in general is Dr. Jennifer Wessels. She's the VP of Transformation, Retail, and Telemedicine for SSM Health St. Louis. She's also a family medicine physician. Dr. Wessels, thanks for joining us. Let's start off with the basics. What exactly is the flu?
Sure. Thanks, Fred. Well, influenza is a virus, and most people typically see it around the fall weather and through the winter and the spring. It is a virus that is contagious. It can affect people of all ages, and you can get symptoms like fevers, muscle aches, congestion, cough, typical cold symptoms, and it can last anywhere from a few days to a week or more.
How is it spread?
It's typically spread by contact from person to person. A lot of that can be spread through the air. So someone sneezes and releases some respiratory droplets through the air. That virus can transmit that way. Also, contact, person-to-person contact or touching, being in close quarters with another person can transmit that virus.
And how dangerous is the flu?
Well, it can be very dangerous for some folks, especially infants or premature babies, older folks as well, our elderly people, or anyone who has any other chronic health conditions or their immune system is weakened or suppressed in any way. So some folks, if they're generally healthy, if they get the flu, they might feel pretty bad for a few days to a week, feel like they have a really bad cold. And some folks who are more at risk, they may end up in the hospital. They could have very serious complications. And some people even die from the flu.
Dr. Wessels, are we seeing any cases of the flu yet?
There have been a couple cases reported thus far, but we've not seen too many as of this time.
When does the flu season hit here?
Well, flu season hits at various times depending on year to year. Sometimes that flu season we'll start to see cases coming in October. In other years, we've seen it later in terms of more hitting January and February months.
So let's talk about the flu vaccine. How important is it for people to get the flu vaccine?
Sure. It's very important to get the flu vaccine. It can help prevent you from getting influenza. It can also help prevent you from spreading it to others. And if you're someone especially who might be immunocompromised or elderly, or even especially our young babies, getting the flu vaccine can mean the difference between life and death.
Who should get the vaccine?
Anybody who is over the age of 6 months old should get the flu vaccine. Now, anyone over age 6 months old who've ever had an allergic reaction to the flu vaccine should not. But other than that, if you've never had a complication from it and you don't have any allergies, you should be getting the vaccine.
Does it work right away?
It does take a little bit of time for your body to absorb that vaccine and to develop immune response to it. But usually within 2 weeks later, you're immune to it.
Are there any side effects from the flu vaccine?
Sure. Like with any vaccine, it might hurt when you get your injection, your shot. You might get a little soreness or redness to that area. If you get your injection in your arm, you might notice a little soreness there. Some people, when they develop an immune response to a vaccine, they might feel a little feverish or a little achy for a couple days, but most people do totally fine getting the vaccine.
Can you get the flu from the vaccine?
That's a really good question, Fred, and a lot of folks ask that. You cannot get the flu from getting the flu vaccine. When we inject people with the flu vaccine, all the substance in there are not live, so you're not going to be able to get a virus by getting a vaccine.
How effective is it?
Generally, the flu vaccine is very effective. That is a little different from year to year. We know the virus changes and mutates year to year, and therefore our flu vaccine components change slightly from year to year. But for the most part, it is a very effective vaccine.
SSM Health next Saturday is offering free flu vaccinations at a variety of sites. Dr. Wessels, can you tell us about that?
Sure. So on Saturday, October 13th, SSM is going to have about six locations where we're offering free flu shots. It's from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. You don't need an appointment. You can walk right in. We're going to be giving flu shots on a first-come, first-served basis. If you're 9 years old or older, you can get a free flu vaccine at any of the SSM clinics. If you are 6 months old and older and as a child, you'll need to go to Cardinal Glennon Hospital to get your flu vaccines there.
We are talking with Dr. Jennifer Wessels. She's the VP of Transformation, Retail, and Telemedicine for SSM Health St. Louis. She's also a family medicine doctor. What's the difference between the flu, the cold, and seasonal allergies? How can you tell what you have?
Sure. So, Fred, seasonal allergies typically are a runny nose, maybe some watery eyes, maybe some sneezing. Usually if you're exposed to something like mold or outside leaves or grass, something you're allergic to, the symptoms usually go away pretty quickly when you're inside or away from that allergen. And you typically don't feel fatigued or lethargic, and you typically do not have a fever. If you have a simple common cold, your symptoms may last anywhere from a few days up to 2 weeks. You might feel a little bit worse than you would if you had seasonal allergies. You might feel more achy, more tired, more congestion. And if you have a upper respiratory virus like a cold, then those symptoms are not going to go away by removing something like an allergen or going inside. If you have true influenza, that's when you'd feel the most ill. You might have a fever, so a temperature 101 degrees or higher. You would feel more lethargic, worse body aches, even worse symptoms in terms of congestion and cough. That's going to be the most severe of the three.
Let's talk about flu prevention tips. Other than the vaccine, which should be the first flu prevention tip, what other things can you do?
Sure. Well, you want to make sure you're always washing your hands, whether that be if you're currently ill and sneezing or coughing, or if you're around others, washing your hands before you eat, before you touch your face. If you are ill or there are other people around you that are ill, you want to make sure that you're staying home if you're sick so you're not exposing other people to that. You're keeping things as clean as you can, so disinfecting things that are commonly touched or held, like phones or doorknobs, so that you're not spreading the disease further between people.
What about antiviral drugs?
There are antiviral drugs for influenza that are there and available to use. If you feel like you have influenza, you are always welcome to see your doctor, go to one of our SSM urgent cares, go to one of our SSM emergency departments and get tested for the flu. If you are suspected or confirmed to have influenza, there are some medications that are available for people when it's appropriate. And likewise, if you've been exposed to the flu, if you have a family member or somebody living within your house that has had the flu, you can also get prophylaxis with antivirals for influenza.
What kinds of flu vaccines are available this year?
There are a number of different flu vaccines available. at all of our SSM facilities, we have all injectable vaccines, so they're all shots. We have some flu vaccines that are safer for younger populations, and we also have some high-dose flu vaccines that are better for some of our older populations.
And the flu mist is being made available in some parts of the country again this year?
In some parts of the country, yes. We will not have flu mist available at our free flu clinic, though, next Saturday on the 13th. It'll be all injectable flu shots.
Okay. Dr. Wessels, go over once again the flu symptoms.
If you think you're coming down with a flu, symptoms might be a fever. It could be muscle or joint aches. It might be cough or nasal congestion, sneezing or stuffy nose. You may also have a headache. You may feel lethargic or fatigued. Those are some very common symptoms of influenza.
Before we let you go, Dr. Wessels, I wanted you to hit just one more time the clinics that are offering the free flu vaccinations next Saturday, October 13th. What do we need to know?
So SSM will have free flu shots Saturday, October 13th from 8 a.m. to noon. It's first come, first serve. You don't need an appointment. Kids who are 6 months or older can go right to Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Other folks that are 9 years old and older can go to St. Mary's Hospital, St. Clair Hospital in Fenton, St. Joe's in Lake St. Louis, DePaul Hospital, or the SSM Health Outpatient Center on Veteran Memorial Parkway.
And you've said everyone over the age of 6 months is encouraged to get a flu shot. What about pregnant women?
Yes, definitely pregnant women are very much encouraged to get a flu shot. And we know that some of that immunity from the flu shot that the mom receives can get carried over into that infant baby as well.
And even if the flu shot is not 100% effective, it does lessen the symptoms and the after effects of the flu?
Yes, that's right. And getting the flu shot, even if you do contract influenza later, it could mean the difference of staying home and feeling mildly ill for a couple days versus being in the hospital and being very seriously ill.
Dr. Jennifer Wessels is the VP of Transformation, Retail, and Telemedicine for SSM Health St. Louis. She's also a family medicine doctor. Dr. Wessels, thanks again.
Thank you, Fred.
Up next, we'll find out about the dangers of infant or baby walkers. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. If your baby or toddler likes to motor around using a baby walker, you need to pay attention to a new study in the journal Pediatrics.
Over the past 25 years, more than 230,000 children have been injured while in a baby walker, most of them falling downstairs. Dr. Gary Smith with the Center for Injury Research and Policy in Ohio says parents should not use them.
And I tell parents that the best parent in the world can't move quickly enough to stop their child from going down the stairs if, say, a young sibling leaves the door open to the basement stairs, even for a moment.
Most of the children who were injured in baby walker accidents suffered head and neck injuries, some even ending up with skull fractures. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
We're joined now in studio by Salute Care pediatrician Dr. Ken Haller at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what's your take on baby walkers?
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended against using baby walkers for years, really decades, because there's been evidence for a long time that these are the sorts of things that can be very damaging to kids. The thing is that, you know, we do want our kids to be able to get around and explore the world, but they can do that on their own. That's what crawling is for. That's what pulling up and cruising is for. The problem with baby walkers is that it gives a child a power and a level of mobility that is beyond the ability of parents to catch up with. It also puts them in a device that is fairly heavy and fairly bulky. And if a device like that goes down the stairs with a baby in it, it can cause real damage to the extremities, to the head, to the neck. And unfortunately, kids have died of injuries that have been caused by this. So the Academy, the American Academy of Pediatrics, has said on many occasions that these should really not be used. And even the term walkers is kind of a misnomer, because no one learns how to walk in one of these things. Kids learn to walk by pulling themselves up and moving around from place to place, and having parents there to watch them do that, having them there to be present while they are taking those steps is really important. Having them in this sort of device is just very, very dangerous.
Any other alternatives to walkers that you would recommend? What about those PlayStations that they sit in?
Actually, a PlayStation to sit in is nice. It's fun. It gives them a place to sit. It also keeps them rather immobile, so that you can watch them, give them things to occupy their time. You can give them books. You can give them little toys and games and things like that. In fact, some parents have said to me, well, you know, grandma gave me a walker. What am I supposed to do with it? Well, what you can do is take the wheels off it and set it on the floor and have your kids sit in it and just play. That's the only good way to use a walker, is to take the wheels off it and make it into a PlayStation.
Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics, as you said, has long been advocating doing away with child walkers. You think they should be banned from the marketplace?
I really don't see any good reason for them to be in the marketplace. I think that there has been enough evidence over the years, and there have been enough kids injured and even killed by these things, that there's no good reason to be selling them. In fact, when parents bring up this topic, I tell them, you know, just don't get it. Get them something else. But really, if we're talking about giving kids mobility, kids are perfectly capable of being mobile themselves. This is part of natural, normal development. For them to go from scooting on the floor to rolling to crawling to pulling up and cruising around, holding on, to finally walking on their own. And they get around pretty good that way. The only way they're going to learn to do it is to do that on their own and with the help of another human being. These walkers don't actually help to promote walking at all, because, you know, they're sitting in this thing and moving their legs. Basically, they're like Fred Flintstone's car, you know, and nobody walks like that. So it doesn't help kids with their walking. It's dangerous. It's the sort of thing that there's really no good use for. So if you're thinking of buying someone a present for a child's first birthday, this is not the thing to buy.
Dr. Haller, thanks. SLU Cares' Dr. Ken Haller is a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Still to come, a closer look at those new car seat recommendations for our kids. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KML.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. I was driving down Interstate 44 last weekend and saw a lot of those electronic highway signs, many of them saying under 4'9", buckle and booster. Well, here to talk about that and tell us all we need to know about car seats for our kids and grandkids is Lori Winkler. She's the Injury Prevention Nurse Coordinator at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. She's also the coordinator of Safe Kids St. Louis. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Wanted to talk about the new and old recommendations for car seats. We just heard a couple weeks ago about some new recommendations that have come out. Start off with telling us about the old recommendations. What were the old recommendations?
So for the old recommendations, for the child to be rear-facing until the age of 2. The reason now for the new recommendations is because of the weight of the car seats. We really want that child to be rear-facing for as long as possible. That is the safest position for them to be in. So some of the maximum weight limits on the car seats has increased as far as that poundage. So therefore, it will allow that child to be rear-facing until they're older than 2 years of age.
How can you tell?
It will state it on the car seat. It will state what the maximum weight and length is for that car seat to be in that position. So, for example, the infant carriers, the one with the handle that most of our new parents like, those are only rear-facing seats, and it will list the length and the weight of that child. What is the maximum for that seat? It's when the confusion comes into play when we go to that convertible car seat, because the convertible car seat can remain rear-facing with a maximum height and weight requirement, but then it gets turned around and it can be utilized as a forward-facing car seat with a different weight and length. So that one lasts the parents longer, okay? However, they have to really pay attention on the side of the car seat where the label is to see what that maximum weight is and what the maximum height or length of the child is to fit in that seat in that position.
Is it because car seats are being better made now that they can change things?
I think that is one of the positives, if you will, one of the reasons. But the other reason is that, more importantly, anatomically, children and babies, their heads are much, much larger than the rest of their body, and their neck muscles are the weakest. And the actual purpose of that car seat, not only to restrain the child in there, but when there's a crash that occurs, a motor vehicle crash, actually three crashes occur. First, the vehicle hits the object. Second, that person hits or strikes something in the car. And then the third is the internal organs are inside of our body, kind of mash up against our skeleton, if you will. So actually three crashes occur with one motor vehicle crash. So if that baby is rear-facing, the energy that's created in that motor vehicle crash, when that collision occurs, what happens is that car seat, it absorbs that energy, the plastic of the car seat and all of that protective safety stuff. It protects or it absorbs that crash, that energy. If they're forward facing, meaning they're facing forward, when that crash occurs, that plastic, guess what, is to the back of the seat. So that energy that's created will be absorbed into that child. Okay. So that's the reason why it is safest for them to be rear facing for as long as possible. Yes, the car seats, they are increasing their weight, maximum weights and lengths. I will tell you, the more expensive car seats and like those all-in-one car seats where the child just needs to be, that car seat will remain with them as long as there's no accident. You know, they have a longer expiration date, but they also have different maximum weights that are allowing the car seats, you know, the children to remain rear facing.
Okay, so let's go over the recommendations again.
Okay.
What are the new recommendations for rear facing car seats?
So in an infant, rear facing only car seat, the recommendation is that the child or that the infant or toddler remains rear facing as long as possible until they reach the height, the maximum height and weight of that specific seat. When they go to a convertible seat, that's the one that can go rear facing or forward facing. Again, they remain rear facing until they've outgrown the rear facing weight and height. Then it goes forward facing and they stay forward facing until they outgrow that weight and height in that position.
Then what about moving into a booster seat?
So once they move into a booster seat, you need to remember, Fred, a booster seat is not a car seat in the sense it does not restrain the child. It is the seat belt that restrains that child. So in order for that child to go in or to get out of their booster seat, we want the shoulder strap to go directly over the middle of their shoulder. The lap belt needs to be over their pelvis and their hip area for them to be properly restrained. The booster seat is nothing more than a plastic phone book. It boosts them up so that restraint system, that seat belt, sits where it's supposed to sit. Because what will happen if the child is not boosted up or sitting up to where the seat belt rests in the proper spot, what will happen is the child will more than likely put the seat belt, the shoulder strap, behind their neck. That has the potential for that child, in the event of a crash, to get ejected or thrown from that seat. But it also creates another problem if the lap belt part is not over their hip and their pelvis and it locks. It usually what happens, because we move our legs, we might start with it at our lap or across our pelvis, but as we're moving around, that lap belt kind of rides up over our kidneys and our intestines. So what will happen is, and if that crash, if that locking mechanism works like it's supposed to for that lap belt, it can perforate the intestines, and it can cause a lot of, it can rupture the bladder, because those are hollow organs. So they're kind of like a water balloon, if you will, and it could perforate that, causing a lot of abdominal trauma for those children.
We're talking with Lori Winkler. She's the Injury Prevention Nurse Coordinator at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. She's also the coordinator for Safe Kids St. Louis. So at what age can kids get out of the booster seat?
There is no age. There is no age, Fred. And that's where the confusion comes in, because the old recommendations were 8 years of age, 80 pounds, or 4'9". The new recommendations, as I was telling you earlier about where the shoulder strap rises, the height is the most important thing. So it's when that child reaches 4'9" is when they can come out of the booster seat and can sit in the car, as long as their back is all the way to the back part of the car seat, you know, of the vehicle seat. Their legs are bending at the seat part, and that their feet don't have to necessarily touch the ground, but they need to be able to bend their knees where the seat, the vehicle seat ends, okay? But usually that will be about anywhere from 8 years old to 12 years of age. So they've removed the recommendation of weight and of age.
And then when can they ride in the front seat?
When they're 13.
So that's
years. 13 years of age. A child needs to remain in the back seat until they are 13 years of age.
It seems to me, when I was a parent, the hardest part of all of this was just getting the car seat in. Do you have some help for listeners that want to know how to get their car seats properly installed?
Absolutely. They can have them, please feel free to give us a call at 678-5474. And we have myself and my two coworkers, we are trained. We have attended a national certification class that's put on through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, as well as Safe Kids. It is actually a 3.5-day course to learn how to correctly install. So I can assure you that your child's car seat will be installed by someone that is currently trained, and it will be installed following the correct new recommendations and guidelines. So our van is out in the community pretty much every day during the week. The other thing is we can do it throughout the community, and we have some fire departments and agencies that we know are certified that we partner with. Not all fire departments have currently trained car seat technicians, and that's where people are like, I went to the fire department, for example, St. Louis City. They used to be trained. But their certification lapsed, it expired, and the grant ran out, so they weren't able to redo it. I am working very diligently with Captain Whitener at the fire department and Chief Jinkerson to try to get our St. Louis Fire Department trained so that they will be a partnering agency with us. Again, they can call us at 314-678-5474, and we can guide them. If they can't come to see us, we can guide them to one of the fire departments that will be more than happy to help them.
Lori, great. That's great information. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Lori Winkler is the Injury Prevention Nurse Coordinator at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Well, we're at the end of another show, and that means our co-host, Lou Cares Dr. Nirav Patel, is back with his health tip for the week. Dr. Patel, what you got?
Well, I think we've talked a lot about antibiotics on this show in general, and I think that it's important that we understand that we live in a very complex world where bacteria are competing for survival, in a sense. And so bacteria have already become resistant to antibiotics that humans haven't invented yet. And if we keep trying to use more and more antibiotics to treat things that are not infection, that's just going to make these bacteria stronger and more adapted to living in our world with antibiotics. So I think it's important that when you're taking care of yourself and you're getting healthcare, you're listening to your physician. If they believe that you do not need antibiotics for a particular thing, then I think that's the best answer.
Dr. Patel, thanks.
Thank you.
SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.